This is Dan Turchin, CEO of Insight Finder. At the end of October, I sat down with a group of executives to discuss the future of AI for IT operations. We discussed all of the things you'd expect, you know, geeky stuff like anomaly detection and automated root cause analysis. But it was also a bit of a therapy session. We discussed what makes the CIO's job so hard, and why automation's the best way to satisfy the insatiable thirst for tech services to run the business, and the unrealistic expectations users have for uptime and performance. At Insight Finder, we're committed to helping enterprise CIOs thrive where most fail. We believe complicated new service architectures and machine data got us into this mess. And the best AI tuned to deliver a better end user experience will get us out of it. Without further ado, listen and learn from some of the best in the business.
I'm Mark Settle, born in upstate New York, in Rome, New York. I left Okta about a year or so ago. I've been advising startup companies and frankly having probably too much fun over the last couple of months. I've had an opportunity to work with several VCs as well. And so that's my role. I'm playing an advisory role at the moment, getting to do a fair amount of talking and writing about topics of interest to me as well. Biggest ops challenge. So over the course, I'd say like the last 6 months, I've taken a deep dive into privacy data management and automation tools. I'm trying to put together an automation council next year to kind of look at this whole phenomenon of automation disillusionment. So I think people spend a lot of money, you know, chasing a lot of things that just don't meet the heightened expectations that people have for that technology. But for next year, there's two topics I'm going to focus on, and you know, we can follow up maybe one-on-one with me and anybody else on the call. I'm really interested in the next generation of DLP technologies, you know, and that whole SASE thing that's going on. But I think there needs to be a more fundamental rethinking of how we think about data loss prevention. And these low-code development platforms I find really intriguing, because I think, you know, the pendulum has swung so far to SaaS that maybe it's time for it to swing back, and you'll see application teams turning out bespoke applications to perform a specific process or to support the activities of a, you know, specific kind of a work group. So kind of two research projects that I'm teeing up for next year around DLP and low code stuff. There you go.
Because Mark didn't plug his own books, I'm going to plug them. So two essential reads for kind of high-tech CIOs. Truth from the Trenches came out first, and then more recently, Truth from the Valley. So because I'm on Mark's advanced PR team, I felt the need to plug those.
I'd also, outstanding Christmas gifts for, you know, your techie friends that you're struggling to figure out, like, what the hell can I give this guy? So there you go.
I didn't catch your quarantine hobby, Mark.
Quarantine hobby. I've taken on some reading projects. So the one I'm in right now is I'm reading biographies of all the British prime ministers since Robert Walpole in 1720, which is an interesting evolution.
Wow, that's admirable. All right, let's go around the horn. Sean, you want to go next?
Sure. I'm Sean Barker. I was born in Southern California and lived most of my life there. I currently am the CEO of CloudEQ, which is a consulting and professional services organization that does all cloud-based infrastructure ops, application development, management, and managed services. So we got onshore and offshore kind of facilities. In order to keep the cost down. And we're working with a number of Fortune 500, Fortune 100 companies. So it keeps us fairly busy. The biggest ops challenge that we kind of face is wading through the sheer number of tools and services and SaaS products and things that are available out there. To, you know, we've locked in on several that we like, but tomorrow there's going to be five more that come out that do, you know, that also make breakfast and coffee and, you know, cost less and, you know, going down that path. And it's just, you know, getting the right timing for the right service, the right tools, the right processes to enable the customers. That's, you know, it's probably one of our biggest challenges. Let's see, quarantine hobby. Unfortunately, I think it's been the refrigerator. spent most of my time either on my computer or in front of the refrigerator. I wish I, you know, I had a few more hobbies, but you know, time is time's a little crazy, as you know. You can't tap somebody on the shoulder and say, "Can you do this? Can you help me?" It comes down to now I got to schedule a meeting to have a 5-minute conversation, and because everybody's time is blocked up, so the hours get longer.
Yeah, good to have you, Sean. Ray, you want to go next?
Sure. My name is Ray Lipick. I was born in a suburb of Chicago, so a Midwestern fellow, and raised there till I was 18. Then went to the West Coast for 20 years, and now back to the Arkansas area for, I guess it's about 22 years now. Work at J.B. Hunt, that small trucking company in Northwest Arkansas, and have the privilege of being the program manager for what we call digital workplace and IT operations. And so we work hard at kind of end user sorts of stuff. And so things like ITSM tools and AIOps tools are important to us as the company's been growing substantially over the last several years and looks to grow a whole lot more in the years to come. We are trying to position ourselves by getting some of those cutting edge tools. And so and that's how we actually found Dan and Insight Finder. And so looking at some of his tools as well. Quarantine hobby. I would say I work at home remote at this point since March. And so being at home a lot, you notice things that need to be done. So my bride and I have this home to-do list and we've been working it down. And it's getting smaller and smaller, thankfully, instead of bigger and bigger. So that's what we've been doing.
Good for you. Good to have you here, Ray.
Good to be here.
Joel, you want to go next?
Yeah, sure. Name is, can you see me? I turned my video. I got my video thing.
Yeah.
See me? That might not be a good thing. But anyway, name's Joel Eagle. Birthplace is Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I lived there for 60 days. And then was when the military gave my mom the okay to join my dad in Stuttgart, Germany. We met him over there. He was deployed there. So my dad's military. So that was my birthplace. Never been back. Never seen Fort Sill, Oklahoma. It's right outside of Lawton, Oklahoma, as I understand it. The company I work for is McDonald's Corporation. So as a career-wise, I came to McDonald's from a company on the West Coast. Southern California, worked there for a number of years. From there, I came from a company in the Southeast, large healthcare company in the U.S. I spent a lot of time doing that, but ended up at McDonald's through a number of different connections, and now been here and living in the Chicago, or actually now living in Chicago I made that move in 2012. Sorry, my brain's got to get caught up. And largely, the role I play today, I was going to say I had something witty that had something about sleeping in a Holiday Inn Express last night, but I didn't know somebody on Holiday Inn's on the call. But anyway, the role I play today, I think, is a chief cat herder. But I run I'm responsible for the cloud platforms. So Azure, AWS, we have a little bit of GCP, not much, but a little bit, as well as our ITSM platforms. So we call it Service Cafe internally. It's ServiceNow built up with a couple of the capabilities that we have. We bolt together and we refer to that as Service Cafe. I also own responsible for our data movement. So you think of EAI and a number of other type platforms that we use to move data all around the world. So think about transaction level data that moves to and from the restaurant, sales data, POS updates, patching, all that sort of stuff that happens around the restaurants. Let me see, what else do I do? Database support, all the database team people that they support there. I'm trying not to leave anybody out. I feel like I'm doing an Oscar thing. In that space, that's largely my remit there. So we do that. Biggest ops challenge. I report to the global CTO, by the way. Biggest ops challenge. So, you know, if I think about it, we have the way the McDonald's is set up. You know, we're certainly a global brand, but we don't operate completely like a global company. We operate a bit like a multinational, and we have a corporate structure where there's the organization. We talk about having suppliers, which are separate companies, obviously, that supply stuff to us, but very integral to what we can deliver, everything from, you know, paper to food, et cetera. And then there's the franchisees, right? So it's the corporation, the franchisees, and the suppliers. We can know that we call that refer to that group as the system. And it's a bit of a challenge to get the system to benefit in most things that we do. So you take a different approach to thinking about suppliers to you, or who you serve, whom your customers are, et cetera. But if you just think about the challenges from an IT perspective of supporting that environment and supporting whether it's data from that, or whether you're talking about level one help desk calls or anything that you have going on to support this, all while expected to reduce costs, improve efficiency, move at speed, and do something meaningful and help the company become or be more improve our competitive advantage. Automation comes into play, right? Everybody keeps asking me, what are you doing about AI, ML? I sometimes want to stop and ask them, do you actually know what that means, right? Can you tell me what AI, ML really means, like the acronym, or you just learn the acronyms now, we moved on. So I struggle with the expectations. I think I'm hearing a little bit of that on the call earlier and here around, what exactly can this do for us? Where can we apply it? Where do we make investments? You know, how do you manage expectations? There's no end to the number of things that we can think of or challenges that we need to overcome. I think for me, the biggest op challenge is when I think about doing things at scale, complexity seems to be the enemy of scalability, right? So the more I'm required to scale something, I'm forced to reduce the complexity, and reducing the complexity means I'm at this gap where I don't understand the automation, AI technology enough to pull the complexity out. So I'm still reliant on a number of what I'll call them legacy type operational models, whether it's level 1, 2, 3, 4 support or typical ways that we think about treating data, stewardship and things like that. So I know that's a big bunch of things, but for me, it would be how do I achieve scalable results and manage complexity, right? And then all the rest of the stuff that goes with that, security, et cetera. Quarantine hobby, letting my beard get shabby. I like to, I was able to get out to the racetrack a little bit and drive some. So I like doing that. I often tell people when I'm in a car going really fast in a racetrack, I don't think about budgets or performance reviews or any other stuff that we have to deal with on the regular part of our job. Every now and then I think about some automation stuff. I think about how this is the machine that around me is working. But for the most part, I just think about surviving, right? And living through the corner and coming out the other end and doing it well. So that's my hobby.
The metaphor for life, Joel.
Yeah.
Well said. Good. Warren?
Okay. Born in Ottawa, Canada, many years ago, moved to Toronto and then Phoenix, Scottsdale. And now I live in New Jersey. So that's another discussion, but a reverse migration right at the peak of the housing bubble. So you know how things are going. My role is working with Dan, love it so far. My hobby, biggest ops challenge, I'll skip that one. It's not as interesting as yours. Quarantine hobby was similar to Ray's. I've got this to-do list, the supporting technologies. I figured out 5 different ways to make coffee, you know, French press. I've got a little Keurig. Mm-hmm. I've got, you know, a variety of different devices to support my home renovation habit.
Nice.
Good. I'll bring us home and then we'll get deeper into the content. So born in Westfield, New Jersey. Just a stone's throw from where Warren is, CEO of Insight Finder. Insight Finder is the AI-first system of intelligence for IT operations. I know a lot of you are familiar with the product, but kind of like the CFO has ERP and the head of sales has CRM, and head of HR has HCM. IT operations has Insight Finder. The biggest challenge that we face on a daily basis, it's complementary in one sense, it's almost the inverse of what Joel talked about. It's helping organizations that understand they have kind of a very abstract mandate to use, quote, AI and ML, figuring out what's the most pragmatic way to onboard automation technology. So get into that in a little more detail. Quarantine hobby, I've narrowed it down to 2. Don't have as much time as I'd like for either of these, but I'm relearning my Spanish, which has become Moy Mall over the last 30 years. And I'm relearning the piano thanks to my kids, who are much better musicians than I probably ever will be. That's me. So I thought I'd spend a few minutes kind of framing the discussion, although truthfully, your tee up of your own challenges is certainly as relevant as anything that I can share, but I get to be on a soapbox for a few minutes, and I'm passionate about this space. This is something I've been doing for 23 years, 7 companies in and around. We now call it AI ops, but applying the principles of automation to IT operations. So I thought I'd share kind of my thoughts on where AI technology is, what at least I see ahead, and kind of call it the next 12 to 15 months. And then some perspectives about, you know, challenges that we're all having, just about how to be successful, not with the buzzwords, but operationally, you know, how to implement, measure, budget for, you know, that sort of thing when it comes to AI first technologies. So little history tour. Like Mark, I like to open the time capsule sometimes. I'm not doing British prime ministers, but I like to be a student of technology. I'm particularly fascinated by the Luddite movement in the 18th century. So that's my connection to Britain. But when it comes to AI, so roll back the clock to the 50s. There was a computing society conference in Hanover, New Hampshire, at Dartmouth College. And this young, handsome professor named Marvin Minsky, who you see there in the top right, proposed this wild idea that there would be a time when tasks that we think can only be done by humans could actually be done by machines. It was pretty radical. Fast forward to the 70s, it became commercialized. It's kind of the early days of what we talked about as the first AI summer, massive infrastructure and academic investment in what was then called artificial intelligence. So it was, you know, term was coined in 1956. But expert systems were basically deterministic workflows, at least that's what we call them now, that would solve problems that, you know, filling out forms or stuff is very rudimentary today, but the idea with some conditional logic, basically if then statements, you could build interfaces, you know, before there was really, you know, certainly no desktop computing, but, you know, with mainframes and punch cards and that sort of thing, you could build some conditional logic and make machines appear to be thinking. So fast forward to the 80s, the technology had become so overhyped, a common theme, that spending dried up, you know, the idea that, you know, these systems were going to become sentient, you know, anytime soon was, you know, it was so far-fetched that, you know, everyone kind of backed away from commercializing a lot of these technologies. In the 90s, kind of the renewed enthusiasm of AI, I would argue, was punctuated by the IBM supercomputer beating Kasparov, actually in only one of three games. So to his credit, Kasparov did win 2 out of 3. But nonetheless, that sent a message that, you know, something that was always thought to be, you know, strategy based and something that, you know, a machine can never be, quote, smart enough or, you know, understand enough patterns to play chess. Well, you know, that was an indication that maybe this AI thing was gonna work out after all. In the last decade or so, a gentleman named Jeffrey Hinton, doing work, I think, at University of Toronto, essentially commercialized neural networks. So now we talk about deep learning, but less about the technology, but more about some of the amazing things that neural nets or deep learning can do. You know, we don't bat an eyelash anymore when, you know, we get accurate recommendations from Netflix or Amazon recommends what we need, or, you know, the Gmail type ahead feature, it recommends, you know, what you're probably going to want to type. These are all things that are aided by neural nets that really was the output from research that was done not that long ago. And, you know, I cite Jeff Hinton, but there's certainly a small but a meaningful cadre of professors that have been part of that. Now, if you look at what's up ahead, maybe not in the next decade, but you know, call it the next, you know, 30 plus years, maybe 40, maybe 50, depends on who you talk to. We're going to move from the point where we're now at, which is what we call narrow artificial intelligence. So in a very specific domain, AI can perform well. For example, you know, routing trouble tickets, or for example, you know, determining the root cause of, you know, an outage. Very narrow. So whether it's supervised using labeled data or unsupervised inferring patterns, that's kind of the state of technology. But in terms of kind of, you know, evolutionarily speaking, the quote smartest AI is probably, you know, about the intelligence of a 9-month-old. So, you know, you're not going to have, you know, your 9-month-old, you know, swinging a bat against Randy Johnson. And, you know, you're not going to have your 9-month-old, you know, doing tests in college. They're 9 months old. They, you know, there's certain things they do well. In the next 30 to 50 years, you'll see what we call AGI, so artificial general intelligence. And that's where just across a broad set of things that you'd associate with kind of human intuition, judgment, we'll actually be able to develop systems that can do a lot of those. There are a lot of interesting early experiments being done with robotics, trained on neural nets and things like that. But they're still very simple today versus what you're going to see. I'm a firm believer that at no time in the near future, probably not in the next century, will we encounter kind of a bot apocalypse, because I firmly believe that humans that develop these algorithms are ultimately have the right intentions when it comes to developing these technologies. I think there are going to be more and more checks and balances up ahead. And I think it'll be a good thing, you know, whether it's for healthcare or education or defense or, you know, agriculture, eliminating famine. I think these are the problems that are actually going to be solved sooner than, you know, the bots are going to become our overlords. So a little bit of soapboxing, but that's kind of where we've been, I think, where we're headed. We talked about the current state. Now, applying AI to you know, where we're at today in IT ops, it's a complex relationship that we as practitioners have with technology. At one point, maybe, you know, a decade, 15 years ago, the technologies were a lot simpler, and we finally started to get gain control over how to monitor them. And even though the monitoring systems were very simple, the applications were very simple too. So kind of simple heartbeat monitors, things like that were sufficient. Well, now what happened is the pace of technology complexity is so far outpacing our ability to monitor and manage these systems that all of a sudden, you know, IT ops went from looking like heroes and being able to, you know, keep up with all of the kind of the digital exhaust from these systems. And now they're just woefully inadequate. And so everyone's kind of scrambling to figure out in the context of, you know, microservices and CI/CD architectures and, you know, dozens of API calls to external systems, like, how do we make sense of all of the new failure points that have been introduced into these systems? And so that's where, you know, you start to get to this need for a more intelligent approach to managing systems at scale. So I'm convinced we're getting there. I'm maybe a little biased, maybe a little Pollyanna-ish, but I think if we look at each kind of element of the service health lifecycle, there are really interesting new technologies, kind of AI-first technologies that are being introduced to improve the ability of mere mortals to manage these complex systems. So if you look at monitoring, so increasingly smart anomaly detection is being used to kind of suppress noise. So you have a manageable number of actionable alerts, event management. So being able to actually do anomaly detection across different types of data, we could never do that before, but now we can look across traces and events and logs and metrics and et cetera, and be able to actually make some sense using typically unsupervised machine learning because there's too much data to label it, but using unsupervised machine learning across all these types of data sources makes some sense out of what's going on, which makes incident management a lot more practical. So we can actually use AI to predict when the next incident is going to happen and what's the most likely cause of it. So when we look at remediation, we may not be at the point where you want the machine or the AI to auto remediate, because there's a lot of risk and there is, you know, there are a lot of different patterns that can occur, but we're getting closer to the point where kind of the input from the AI, the machine, fused with the input from the human, you know, in an ops context, you're going to be able to see pretty accurate root cause analysis just based on a little bit of judgment and, you know, rational thinking from humans fused with the ability of AI to be able to, you know, kind of distill the universe of possible root causes down to maybe two or three. And then lastly, continuous learning. So that's really the strong suit of AI, is being able to detect when a pattern associated with historical outages is about to recur, the learning from the past experience, who was involved, what action did they take, how long did the outage last, you know, these, you know, three or four variables, build those into this learning model. And all of a sudden, before monitoring detects an issue, this continuous feedback and continuous learning loop kicks in and says, hey, you know, here's something you could do proactively to prevent an outage that's otherwise going to happen. Now, I told you I'd do a little bit of prognosticating before we jump into the roundtable. I see three key patterns in kind of, you know, talk a little bit about the evolution of AI, but three things that I see happening even in the next 12 months. And feel free to call me out a year from now if I get the timing wrong. But three things that I feel like are imminent, you know, not on the order of a decade, but closer to on the order of a year to you know, a couple of years. So I think in the workplace, what we now think of as intelligence is going to become ambient. So you walk into a conference room, eventually we will be back in conference rooms, and, you know, detects, you know, who you are. So, you know, what temperature you like the room to be at. And if you book a conference room and there are more people invited than can, you know, be accommodated by the room, then you'll get, you know, an intelligent notification saying you need a bigger room and here's one that's available. You know, now we talk about things like contact tracing. So there's going to be a lot of AI technology applied to making workplaces seem smart, because they're going to know, you know, where it's okay to gather and where it's not okay to gather. And, you know, one big problem that you know, everyone is going to face as they return to work is, if a building's only allowed to be at certain capacity, how do you stage who can be in the building when, and literally how do you schedule the elevators so that we're not waiting, you know, an hour because everyone's trying to, you know, go up in a crowded elevator at the same time. These are all things where, you know, these are problems that are going to get solved by lots of data and interesting algorithms. And it's going to seem like just a smart workplace, but it's all, you know, all supported by data and AI. So a big issue that everyone in the kind of AI first industry is facing is, how do you train AI algorithms without training them to be biased? And this is everyone's problem, and it's probably bigger than we realize. I can give you an example. You know, the world that I've been in, IT ops and IT service management, if a model is getting trained on, let's say, which vendor is the most effective at fixing a problem, and in the training data, most of the data is represented by, you know, call it large global brand name vendors, just for simple, you know, equipment maintenance. Well, what you're going to do is tell the model inadvertently that, you know, large co is more effective at fixing these problems than maybe, you know, the small local minority owned business. So no one intended for that algorithm to have a bias against minority owned business. But if you train the data on what's actually out there, the large companies are more represented in the data. So we're going to start to see kind of, you know, universal, you know, kind of regulation frameworks for how you judge the quality of AI with respect to, you know, simple examples like that. And that applies to, you know, AI making decisions about who goes behind bars. You know, how much risk is, you know, is this sentence for this convicted criminal? Things like that. You know, if we don't create these regulatory frameworks, you're going to see there is the potential for dangerous decisions to get made, and for those decisions to reinforce subsequent AI first interactions, but I think we're going to, as a society, I think we're going to get really good at judging AI. And then lastly, I think it was Mark alluded to low code environments. In my humble estimation, I see in the next 12 to 18 months, low code environments winning in terms of, you know, we talked about the cliche of the citizen developer, but I think what we have traditionally called coding is going to become a commodity because the low code systems are getting so efficient and, you know, they're so adept at making everyone essentially a programmer. I think that the future of what we've called programming is really the quality of your thinking with regard to machine learning and data science. So I think, you know, the ML developer is the new programmer. And I see that happening rapidly. Again, I'm biased. I spent 4 years at ServiceNow. It's a very popular low code platform, but seeing the power of what you can do today with no C, no Python, typically not even any JavaScript, and you know, playing that out, you know, 12 to 18 months, it's pretty clear that at no time in the near term future will the skills required to develop and train machine learning algorithms be outsourced to machines to write or train the algorithms on their own. So I think that's going to become the new kind of point of demarcation when it comes to evaluating technical skills and also what the market's willing to pay for. These skills are in high demand, short supply. Okay, so I told you a little bit of me soapboxing. I do want to use the balance of the time, which is too little, to have a discussion. And I thought I'd start with your perspectives on, you know, we talked a little bit about what the technology can do, but you know what? Your employees don't care about what the technology can do. They just care about, does it or does it not solve a problem they have? So we'd love to hear your perspectives on, if you're using the technology today, how, and how do you think about what are the right business problems to solve with AI?
So Dan, this is Joel. I'll go in. You know, we started down the path with you a while back doing the auto routing of trouble tickets, you know, based on, you know, level one help desk people interacting with the help desk, and then we started to improve our ability to understand what we're doing there, auto route tickets. You know, the beginning of that was all about, hey, we can reduce costs, improve efficiency, but ultimately it's about improving that customer experience right around what we're doing. Today we are trying to, I have this bent that I'm on. I call it no ops, right? I'm trying to get to the point where, even though I'm responsible for what would be, you know, a lot of infrastructure area with cloud, the interaction to it, particularly from our legacy environments, that I'll call it back office and legacy that we put into largely the Azure environment. You know, it's the people who operate those and the contracts they have for suppliers and like that still reflect the world of the data center, right? As you know, McDonald's is in fact, by the end of this year, we will be at all of our compute will be cloud-based, with the exception of an AS400 that we have to worry about at a mainframe. But everything else is in the cloud, right? And I'm going to shoot the mainframe. It's the last thing I do, and it'll be dead by the end of next year. But anyway, the point is, it comes back to I need to improve this self-service capability to the point where either I'm using low code type applications where I can build self-service, right? So I can say, I need to understand, you know, cobble together from technology a capability. The capability then needs to be consumable. And in order to do that, I've got to have some amount of, whether you want to call it artificial or autonomous or some way of handling variability, right? And the way somebody wants to engage with that, right? So the you know, part of the example I like to use is, you know, when I talk to people, particularly internal to the organization, you know, I ask them, you know, the minute they want me to do something or change something or put some technology in or build some portal or build a capability for them, it's about organizational change management. It's about training. It's about all these things that you have to go off and do and explain the complexity of all of it. And I'm saying, how do I get to the point where I'm just an app on your phone? And you like the app because it does something for you. So you download it and you use it. And you don't actually call up, you know, American or United or Delta to figure out how to use the app. You don't call your bank to figure out how to use the app. You just download it and you use it because you want to. This is the, to me right now, if I could get to that, that's my holy grail of, you know, the Terminator or whatever, the bots, right? It's like, we can we can just put capability out there on a platform that has the ability to then start learning and understanding how to overcome the exceptions, to make the exceptions a way I can automate the handling of exceptions. This accelerates then the ability to provide that level of, I'll call it ease, right, or customer experience. That's where I'm trying to get to, and I have no clue how to do it at the moment.
Good example.
So I agree with Joel on the no ops portion. I think we're looking at, you know, less ops, right? And
sounds like an ops guy talking.
But yeah, I mean, most of the engagements that we're doing today are really focused on how do we automate everything and make life, you know, work through a CI/CD pipeline and do DevOps and really enhance the ability to go fast and remediate, you know, issues as they come about within application development or what have you. I think as we move towards low code apps, I think that will get better. Dan, I think we're a little further out, mostly because of the transition time that it's going to take to do the change management, to do the adoption, to do, you know, the shift from what customers and companies have today over to a low code option. But you know, many of the companies or engagements we have are not only doing automation, but they're looking, you know, a bit more forward towards AI and ML and how do we take all this automation that we've done and now auto remediate problems within the ops environment. What are the right algorithms? And it's going to be, you know, kind of in the same way we've always done things, to say what's the low hanging fruit and how do we eliminate those things first. I do think we will struggle with bias, right? Because we'll structure things off. Well, everything starts out structured off what you know, and then biases develop. But I think over the long run, you know, I think we can get there. And to, you know, to Joel's point, if it long term becomes an app that you just know how to use and do it because you want to, that makes it that much better for, you know, for the customer, or the client, or the constituents within that client. Make sense?
Yeah, Ray, I'd love to hear your perspective. You know, we have known each other a long time, but I know your team was very intentional about picking a business problem. How was that discussion internally?
What really drove it is the company's been growing over the last several years, and we have older technology in place that needs to be upgraded so that as we continue to grow, the technologies that we have in place can do some of the things that you were actually talking about earlier. And that is be able to identify a problem when you have multiple tools in place that are coming up, monitoring things, but coming up with alerts. And well, which one is the biggest issue right now? And how do we get to root cause fast? So we have some of these systems in place, Dynatrace, Hop, and SolarWinds. And they have lots of alerts at times. So what do you do quickly to address it so that it's the maximum efficiency and effectiveness for the company while the company's growing, both in capacity, capability, but also people, and which means more alerts and more things going on. And then we've obviously been thinking through how do you measure that as well. So we've been looking at metrics and revamping and rethinking what's the best metrics that we need to look at. That has been morphing and changing, we hope improving, but it's all connected, you know, it's a bit of a challenge. So how to be more efficient and effective at what we're doing is the bottom line in the operations world. So I oversee seven different towers, all end user related. And so we care a whole lot about how the operations work, but need to be more efficient at it. So what tools ITSM wise, what AI ops tools, which ones work best together? Is a platform better than point tools? Those are questions we have been looking at very carefully over the last a couple of years, but very intentionally over the last 3 or 4 months, and trying to come to some conclusions even at that. Mark, I hope that answers your question, Dan.
But yeah, no, that's good perspective. That's why I wanted you to chime in on that. Mark, you interact probably with more CIOs than anyone. These kind of challenges that you guys have been discussing, are those the ones that you typically hear around, you know, making the business more successful, or what do you think is keeping CIOs at night these days?
On the upside, you know, most people are migrating to the cloud. Many are using dual provider solutions. They have maybe one set of apps up on Azure and another set on AWS. Flexera published an interesting report. There's very little cross use of management tools between different clouds. So when people are supporting hybrid cloud environments, you know, your team has got to develop some sophistication around multiple tools. You know, maybe some of the kind of technologies we're talking about here could smooth over some of those differences or provide some kind of a, you know, more common front end in terms of triaging, et cetera. But the ease of spinning up infrastructure on demand is so great these days, like you alluded to before, the complexity that, you know, everybody bitches about they're spending more money than they expected in the cloud. And it's because they really don't know how to like turn stuff off and use it effectively. There's that issue. You know, and then there's the unbridled data replication that occurs with all of the security and privacy problems that can lead to as well. And enforcing regulatory controls, you know, so automated procedures, one of the great things about automated procedures is they provide the kind of evidence that auditors are looking for in many cases that controls have been upheld as well. So when, if you turn a whole bunch of software guys loose and say, here's your AWS, you know, sandbox, get your toys out and like go have fun. You know, things get out of control, can get out of control pretty quickly. So I think there's a lot of concern, you know, in that kind of area. But just as a bottom line, I mean, any transactional process, whether it's security alerts or server alerts or storage volumes or network traffic or whatever, you know, I think lends itself to the use of AI tools to provide more quality assurance.
Joel, you brought up at the beginning, there's not really a shared definition of what AI and ML are. Be curious to get everyone's perspective on what the business is expecting. What does AI mean? What does the business think IT and IT ops is doing with AI? And then the reverse of that question, do you think those expectations are reasonable?
I can certainly speak from our side when it comes to the business. AI ops means sort of like this magic poof dust that you are able to sprinkle onto operations and all of a sudden everything is fixed fast. That would be a perspective from some. Those that look at it a little bit closer realize that is not reality. And so the other side of it is, some think that, like you said, this is going to be a long time coming. So why even spend too much time, effort, energy, and money investing in it until it's better down the road? So we sort of have two spectrums that we deal with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
You know, I'm with you definitely. The poof dust that, you know, makes everything better, I think, is the expectation. I think there's still a great deal of effort that needs to take place and investment that needs to take place in making AI really efficient for companies. I mean, you can go collect all the telemetry data and, you know, you have the, you know, you have the what, right? And then you need to work through the, you know, so what, through all that data and slim it down to what can you do with it, which becomes the now what, right? So as you look to gather the data and get it to get smarter about, you know, what's going on and how to find these things and which things to suppress and which not to suppress, you know, there's time, effort, energy, and money to invest there. And it's not going to be magic poof dust for quite some time, but I think it will be, you know, I think it's going to continue to get better. And as we go forward, that level of investment and understanding and maturity in the overall AI and ML world will really help the organizations long term. But I don't think it's going to solve the problem, you know, immediately today in an instant, which is, I think, the expectation of those who are writing checks, right?
It is, Sean. In fact, this number five on the roundtable discussion of managing expectations is one of the things I find myself doing fairly often with our execs, because there is a desire for us to obviously be effective and efficient and not spend too much money, but do it fast. And so there's all these things going on that you're trying to say, well, we want to do all of that, but we have to be wise about how we do it and how we think about it.
Yeah, for us, I think it's there's the expectation is that because you've got a number of the industry hype, because of the number of people out there that are pushing everything from log aggregation and learn and machine learning around what it can do. The outcome is this, right? They think we are applying AI or ML type technologies to reduce the MTTR or the length of an outage, overall the impact of an outage. We should be using it to do that, learning each time. We should be able to use AI and ML to predict when an outage is going to happen. So prevention, so outage prediction and prevention is somewhere where there's an I hear this all the time in terms of the expectations, like what are you doing around this? Because every single time somebody like, I don't know, McKinsey, Lloyd, Accenture, anybody else that gets my CIO's attention for 5 seconds, tells them all the stuff you could be doing and millions can be saved. The management leadership here is not, they're not idiots, right? They're not stupid, but they just kind of flip the question over to you and ask you, hey, I heard about this. What are we doing here? I heard about this. What are we doing here? And it could be because the CEO's asking them that as well, right? But there is the expectation that it's out there in the marketplace. Everybody's familiar with the hype cycle, but there's enough I'll call it momentum out there with enough companies making money doing this that they believe it's not just snake oil, right? That we should be able to do something demonstrable with it. We should have I like the one and two, right? Or at least with two, with the picking the right success metrics. It's like we should be able to have some, I think the expectation now is that I should be able to have some metric that I can point to, whether it's MTTR, P1, whatever, and show where I'm applying some type of automation to affect that metric. That is harder to do, or proving to be harder to do than most people expect, or most people understand, and that expectation is hard to manage.
Well, you know, I hate to be too contrary, but, you know, in some ways, I think a lot of times, people outside IT, I mean, they really don't care what the technology is. I was having a discussion earlier this week about executive perceptions about DevOps tools, DevOps techniques, and are we sophisticated enough? You know, if you're building something, frankly, everybody else outside of the engineering function, they don't really give a flip. They just want to know, like, you know, we're getting features out faster than the competitors, or we're able to blunt some kind of a new startup by mimicking their capabilities in the first 3 months they were competing with it. You know, those kind of business questions are the way they look at things. So, you know, if, like the MTTR, well, if there aren't any anomalies in a way, and there aren't any significant anomalies that reach their level of attention, how IT is taking care of all that stuff in the background, you know, I don't think that most of the time they're not technology advocates. They're not probing. Now, the CIO is going to, you know, maybe ask some questions, but I don't know if the head of sales or, you know, the head of HR or the head of marketing is going to be wondering what we're doing over here. So,
yeah, I agree. Yeah. Well, again, I'm sensitive to time. I know it feels like we're just getting started, and you know, we could definitely go hours. And but in the interest of having some next steps, I told you one of the hopefully the biggest value you'll get out of this session is meeting each other. And so I'll circulate your contact information, and happy to share these slides if you're interested. Just want to make sure we've at least seeded some conversations that you can have offline, so you can be good resources for each other. One of my favorite quotes, I think it's more true now than ever, the pace of innovation has never been as fast as it was yesterday, or as slow as it will be tomorrow. And to me, that kind of, in one pithy statement summarizes kind of where we're at. I'm quite bullish on the future. And with that said, we're at the top of the hour. Really just appreciate you making time for us, and hopefully get value out of this, not just from, you know, this short hour, but from conversations that it turns into.